This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
When big systems flip into another state, that is trouble for species needing normal, like us. We get the latest on global tipping points in 2023 from one of the world's top experts, Professor Tim Lenton from Exeter University. Then we explore Earth energy imbalance at the poles with Hamish Prince and Greenlash, backward steps in the European Union. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Large-scale, rapid climate change may be the biggest threat to humanity and life as we know it. Earth systems may not change gradually at a steady rate, but could bounce into a new state with no return. The point of time when a shift is determined and unstoppable is called a tipping point. Right at the center of tipping point research is Dr. Timothy Lenton. At the University of Exeter, he is chair in climate change and earth system science. Lenton is lead author of the new Global Tipping Points report for 2023. This is what we know so far. From Exeter, UK, Tim Lenton, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me back at the program.
We last talked in 2020 about the report Climate Tipping Points Too Risky to Bet Against. In the new Global Tipping Report for 2023, I see a change, because in the earlier interview you said, almost quietly, you feared at least one tipping point had already been crossed. 4 years later, with a torrent of new science, are we more certain and are more tipping points already in play?
Yes, unfortunately, I think we identify up to five that might be already in play or already crossed, and the whole catalogue of ones that we could cross has unfortunately grown considerably. And yeah, we know we're at risk, for example, for large-scale dieback and loss of coral reefs, which we're tragically seeing happening again live right now. Yeah, and alongside that, there are a couple of major ice sheets, West Antarctica and Greenland, at clear risk, and parts of the frozen soils of the north, the permafrost, thawing abruptly. Yeah, and then there's a part of the circulation of the ocean in the North Atlantic that we see worrying signs of being close to a tipping point.
Yes, and when I talked to Matthew England in Australia, he said that the Antarctic polar bottom, the circulation there, had already tipped, in his opinion.
Exactly. So it was last year, 2023, had these most extraordinary deviations of ocean surface temperatures in large regions, as well as extraordinary extent of fires, for example, across the Canadian boreal forest. So in short, some shocking and surprising things are going on in the climate system that even specialists like us would really struggle to attribute to just being part of some kind of smooth overall change of the climate. Instead, we see this growing evidence of possibly abrupt and possibly irreversible changes, tipping points.
Posts on social media tell us many people do not understand ecological tipping points. They believe that polar ice ends all of a sudden or species go extinct at the tipping point. What is the reality between the point of tipping and its final destination?
Well, that's a great question that kind of depends on the system and its own timescales. I think as a kid I was kind of taught, well, if you lived in the life of a fly, humans would seem like this very, very slow thing, whereas to us, the fly is this very fast thing that lives short and dies. In the Earth as a system, ice sheets are really slow things compared to a human time scale, whereas the circulation of the atmosphere and the weather is a really fast thing, like the fly, compared to a human time scale. So fast things can tip fast, like the atmosphere. Really slow things, like the ice sheets, they may tip. It may be very hard to reverse the loss of an ice sheet, but that doesn't mean it feels or seems or unfolds quickly for humans. So yeah, there are big differences. We might pass the tipping point for an ice sheet, but have watched the consequences unfold for several centuries. Whereas if we tip a bit of one of the monsoons in the tropics, maybe we see the difference from one year to the next. And when it comes to ecology that you mentioned, well, actually, it's an interesting mix. Sometimes, if you imagined a scenario like tipping the loss of a large chunk of the Amazon rainforest, that probably, at least in models, takes the order of a decade to unfold. Although individual trees can be killed quickly by individual drought events or fires. So yeah, it's kind of all about scales and the natural time scales of things.
So the Potsdam Institute, the Stockholm Resilience Center, your own group at Exeter raised even more worrying possibilities. Tipping points do not operate in a vacuum, and they might influence one another. Can you give us an example of how tipping points might cascade?
Yeah, so in the Arctic, we see unprecedented warming. I mean, 3 or 4 times as fast as the rest of the planet. That is to do with replacing a highly reflective white sea ice surface with a really dark sunlight-absorbing ocean surface, which in itself, parts of that might be a tipping point. But that extra Arctic warming means a couple of things. It's contributing to the accelerated melt and potential tipping of the Greenland ice sheet, and that's a source of fresh water that pours off the ice sheet into the neighbouring bits of the North Atlantic Ocean. The warmer Arctic is also meaning more snow and rain in the Arctic, which is also like a source of fresh water into the surface ocean. And fresh water pouring into the surface ocean of the North Atlantic can disrupt a crucial process where the surface waters get cold and salty enough and therefore dense enough to sink from the top to the bottom of the ocean. And if you stop that process, which we call deep convection, it can stop the great overturning circulation of the Atlantic Ocean, which drags a huge amount of heat from the southern hemisphere across the equator into the northern hemisphere, especially into the North Atlantic region. So if you stop that circulation, it has some other major knock-on effects. It moves the band of rainfall around the whole tropic that rings the tropics of the planet southwards. That means it could seriously disrupt the monsoon in West Africa, in India, and also over South America, including the Amazon. And shutting off the ocean circulation, or that part of it, can leave basically heat behind in the Southern Ocean, where it could go to work to melt the West Antarctic ice sheet and parts of the East Antarctic ice sheet. And in that way, it's a cascade of possible tipping points from one pole, the Arctic, to the other, the Antarctic.
Tim Linton, you also worked on early warning signs that a system may be destabilizing, and that seems like very important information to have if we can get it. What have we learned?
Actually, the last few years have seen a bevy of recent research on these early warning signs for tipping points. What we've learned is that there are signs that several of these big systems are showing that they're losing stability and that they are heading in the direction of a tipping point. That doesn't necessarily tell us how close, but it tells us we're heading in the wrong direction, and that's for a key part of the Greenland ice sheet. It's for the great overturning circulation of the Atlantic that I just mentioned, and it's also for, in our own research, the Amazon rainforest. We see clear signal of destabilization, and this signal that's common across the systems, the early warning signal, is that before you get to a tipping point, a system gets less good at recovering from the little shocks it might be getting from the world, perturbations we call them in science, and it recovers more slowly from perturbations. It might also undergo a bigger change when given the same size of little shock. Yeah, we detect those early warning signals consistently across those systems, and in fact almost every week now a paper seems to be coming out, or every month at least a paper's coming out with more of this kind of evidence, several of them for this great overturning circulation of the Atlantic, which is arguably the biggest tipping point.
Is there only one tipping point for each big process like ice melt, or thousands of ice tipping points in 1,000 locations?
Well, that's a great question as well, because certainly for if you think of something like coral reefs, there are lots of different reefs, and they certainly individual reefs can have their individual tipping point. And then it becomes a question about whether some sort of heat wave in the ocean can be over a sufficiently large area that it tips a much bigger area of reef, like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. And as you mentioned, ice sheets, it's also when you study in detail ice sheets like the ones on East and West Antarctica, you find, oh yes, well, major glaciers could each have their own tipping point, but then if you lose one big glacier, it can destabilize the next one in a kind of cascade. And earlier this year, I and a bunch of colleagues started writing about this sort of view of, I don't know if you want to call it nested tipping or something like that, but how tipping phenomena can sometimes spread out from smaller scales, again cascading over bits of an ice sheet or whatever, to larger scales.
And then we have the human influence, because one of the key points in the new report, quote, is the effects of tipping points will be transmitted and amplified throughout our globalized world. Could you talk about that, Tim?
The worrying interpretation of that, of course, is, let's take a scenario like the one I mentioned of a tipping of the Atlantic's overturning circulation. It's known as the AMOC for short. Well, we calculated, okay, what would this do for the area on which we could grow major staple crops like wheat and maize worldwide? And we quickly found out that it could halve, or more than halve, the area upon which you could grow those major staple crops. Well, you don't have to be a scientist or a genius to see that if you halve the area to grow wheat and maize worldwide, which are two of the major staple crops, we're going to have some food security issues. We'll certainly have a drastic rise in price of wheat and maize because of a supply-demand balance shift. Whether it would literally mean people starving because food became too expensive, well, we know that in just the last decade or so, when wheat prices go up, this tends to cause rioting and social unrest. And many authors attribute the so-called Arab Spring to rising grain prices and food prices. But that would be mild compared to what you'd get if you had this big-scale tipping point, which would also be not a one-off event, but pretty much irreversible. So in that sense, we're talking about social tipping dynamics. Like when people got out on the streets protesting in the Arab Spring against their leaders, partly agitated by the fact that, you know, they couldn't afford to feed themselves. Well, when you have a political protest that escalates, or even a political revolution it might result in, that's a classic case of social tipping dynamics where, you know, the first person protesting, it's quite a bold move and you might get, you know, stamped on by the police or whatever, but you make it incrementally easier for the next person to protest and join you, and he makes it incrementally easier for the next person, and that's what we'd call a reinforcing or amplifying feedback, and it's how and why protests can sort of explode in size. So I hope that gives a sense of how you can go from the realm of tipping in the climate through resources or things that we really need and care about, water, food, whatever, to other kinds of dynamics that are tipping dynamics within a society, and not, in this case, not always good ones. I mean, there are other, you can also think of peace to war as a kind of macabre tipping point as well.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the University of Exeter. Our guest is Professor Tim Linton. We're talking about the report Global Tipping Points 2023. Okay, you raised these social tipping points, and you concluded our 2020 interview with that optimism that good tipping points can develop in human society, and sure, revolutions are part of history. So you end this new 2023 report with the same hopes. What can you tell us about this and about your possible coming book?
Yeah, what I can say at the top level is things are bad enough now in the climate that incremental action is not going to be viable or save us from the worst consequences of climate change and nature loss. And so our argument, and certainly the argument I'm making in the book I'm writing, is we've left it too late. Our best and probably only hope of getting to a good place now is to trigger what I call positive tipping points, which are self-propelling, self-accelerating changes towards the new technologies, behaviors, social norms that we need to flourish in a sustainable way. And I'm talking about things like we now see the exponential growth of solar and wind power worldwide as they become the cheapest forms of power generation. We see similar exponential growth of electric vehicle uptake, whether that's cars or two-wheelers and three-wheelers in the global south. And we might also be beginning to see the signs of a sort of tipping of social norms away from empowering society by fossil fuels and subsidizing all of that and towards this different, greener future of clean energy and all the rest of it. So what we do in the recent report is try to catalogue and document some of the evidence of those positive tipping points that are already starting to happen at national scales and even in global marketplaces. Also highlight some of the ones that have the potential to occur if we all take matters into our hands and act in ways that bring forward, if you like, the positive tipping points. And yeah, I'm trying to write what I hope will be a popular book on this subject, where I do that mixture as well. I talk about the tipping points that are the good ones that are already triggered, and then I look carefully at, okay, what's the enormous potential for more of these, and how could policy actions and us as individual consumers and businesses and the media and all the rest of it play a part in bringing forward what I would argue are the positive tipping points we need to basically stop fossil fuel burning, shut down greenhouse gas emissions as fast as possible, and get a load of co-benefits along the way.
But we have to acknowledge there are possibly many negative tipping points in history as well. And if we believe the news, a wide array of negative points are triggered now, from authoritarianism to gang rule and extreme drugs. Do you include negative social tipping points in the report language?
We do. In fact, the whole Global Tipping Points report is a sort of, I don't know if it's a giant balancing act, but it seeks to talk openly and candidly about the possibility of going down bad paths of negative social tipping points and the risks of those, as well as trying to offer some a friend of mine calls plausible grounds for hope with the positive tipping points. So we're very cognizant that societies are complex with many actors with different agendas and so on and so forth, and that things could kind of go either way or possibly in a mixture of ways. On the plus side, at least we're not completely powerless in all of this. I think one of the major messages we're trying to get across is, although climate change can seem enormous and frightening, quite rightly, especially to us specialists, and we can seem small in comparison, we do actually have some agency or some power to be part of change, and that includes these changes in behavior and technology that could save us still maybe from the worst of the climate tipping points. Equally, other acts, human actions could only act to exacerbate trouble. But again, it's sort of in our hands. We'll be that are making those actions.
Does your mission to promote positive social tipping points have origins in your belief in Gaia, like a vision of self-organizing life?
Yes, in the broadest sense that I look back as a scholar of Gaia and Earth history, and I see that the only reason we're here having a conversation, breathing an oxygen-rich atmosphere with a relatively cool climate and little CO2 in the atmosphere, is thanks to the activities of past life forms, mostly microbial, and very occasionally some innovation in the microbial world ended up completely changing the atmosphere. Like once upon a time, 3 billion years ago, a microbe invented, in inverted commas, the kind of photosynthesis we're familiar with that pumps out oxygen as a waste product, and a few hundred million years later that ultimately led to tipping the atmosphere into a more oxygen-rich state and so on. So I kind of know that the little guys can sometimes change the world, because that's what Gaia and the history of our planet teaches us. And I think that's kind of a way we need to engage with our current situation. We need to realize we've got some agency, some power. But also, we need to, the bottom line for me, the end point of all of this involves, anyway, a shift in worldview where we realize and honor or somehow value the contribution of other living things to our own existence and life support more than we do at the moment, predominantly in the culture. So, yeah, Gaia kind of informs this thinking in perhaps both those ways.
I'd love to have time another day to talk to you about Gaia 2.0 and your study into the origins of complex life. Fascinating things. But in the meanwhile, the Tipping Point report acknowledges, as you just said, that big social change may not come in time to avoid crossing some tipping points. So what do we do then?
Well, we make quite a strong set of statements to back up the Bridgetown Initiative and others that are calling for a much more substantive global governance and finance response to deal with the losses and damages that are already occurring and could get a whole lot worse as we may pass these Earth system tipping points. So we're pretty clear on the need that there is a need to mobilize resource in many senses to help those who are going to be put in situations that there isn't much of a viable adaptation option for. There'll be lots of others in situations where there are adaptation options, but they also need resource to realize those chances to adapt to reduce the worst impacts and vulnerability to the tipping points. So I don't think anybody claims to have quite solved or worked out how we change the global governance rule structures to actually effectively mobilize more money and more resource into this crucial area of loss and damage and adaptation. But many of us are sort of passionately trying to build the social and political momentum that's necessary to get to that place. It's the fundamental issue of climate and nature injustice, basically.
I worry the tipping point report examples, like electric cars, are too narrow, looking for change within the existing system. Now, of course, we have to start from wherever we are, but are we ready for a real revolution if it's required, say, away from capitalism or, whatever it takes?
I agree that I used a quite narrow kind of technology substitution example with the electric cars. I would argue that the tipping point to renewable energy is, as many authors have noted before, not just about changing literal electric power source. It is also about a fundamental shift in political power and geopolitics, because once the world is tipping to renewable energy, suddenly the 80% of people in the world that live in nations that are net fossil fuel importers are in a immediately better economic situation, and they are clearly the majority. That power source is much more widely distributed than fossil fuels. So it'll rebalance in a fundamental way power and in the political sense as well as a literal electrical sense. But yeah, deeper than that, you're asking the right question, and we do in the report go into that territory of, okay, at some point, at least it's clear that we're not going to get out of trouble if we carry on with the so-called neoliberal version of capitalism, with deregulating everything. And those paradigms, political, are going to have to tip as well to really exit fully out of trouble. So yeah, we touch on that territory, and perhaps you could think of it as we try to cover all that territory and also take, I don't know whether I should use a pragmatic stance, but you also have to work with the world as it confronts you, not as you would wish it to be. And I think by instigating changes that become self-propelling, be they in energy sources powering society or in how we eat or use the land, then history teaches us a bit about how that will probably ultimately manifest in more fundamental changes in politics and power and hopefully how we see the world. I agree that we're going to end up there one way or another, but we have to have radically accelerated action now to reduce the sources of the greenhouse gas emissions.
I could see an emergency where powerful nations finally decide they are going to slash fossil fuel burning, and maybe they will also decide not to deliver any more to poorer countries, freezing their economic development. What makes so many scientists so certain that only a just and equitable solution will save the environment?
Well, I guess we are moral beings like everybody else, and we seek for a more just and equitable world, as well as one where we've got out of a climate and nature crisis. But my version of justice and equity involves other species. I'm an open supporter for rights of nature, and so on and so forth. So, yeah, what to say, really? No one is sure that that is how the future will unfold, but I believe it is. We have some agency or some power to determine, okay, what kind of future do we want to work towards? And I think whilst I've stressed some of the technological and behavioural elements of that, as you've stressed, that's also a deeply political proposition. So a kind of systems thinker like me has to see it in all angles, I think, has to see it as, well, if this is ultimately a political transition, then we have to be absolutely clear what is our politics, what is our framework of justice for whom and for what, and that's got to be underpinning, that's got to be part of the great compass or whatever, the moral compass, whatever you want to think of, that's behind this or driving this. But yeah, what's behind this is people are dying from climate change already, and those people are overwhelmingly less well off, often usually in the global south, oppressed by a current system, if you like, anyway. So yes, all of this wraps around to a sort of systems view, I guess, of several dimensions.
Well, I also think it just won't work, because if you have a lot of poorer people, they're going to see the richer people and they're going to come and either take or ask for their share, and you'll have mass migrations and so on. We won't go all the way down that path. What I want to know now is, what do you want the United Nations to do, Tim?
Well, we've got a sympathetic Secretary General at the United Nations, that's for sure, because he has been essentially putting our message out there as well on the risks of the bad tipping points and the need for a sort of fully justice-grounded response. Yeah, in terms of international action, I think what I want to communicate most is that it doesn't have to take everybody to agree on everything in order to instigate some positive tipping point changes that can accelerate action to limit global warming. What we know is that with the right coalition of actors with a strong interest in driving the change first get together, they can be enough to tip everybody else to ultimately follow in major sectors of activity, like, I don't know, for example, tipping towards electrified transport, or tipping the power sector, tipping to a situation where now solar and wind are the cheapest technologies. Basically, typically, you may need, it can vary, but 10 to 25% of the represented population, if you like, tipping in a new direction can, for the diffusion of many technologies, can be enough to eventually cause everybody else to follow. So smart kind of international policy now is about those who see a shared interest and advantage in making the change happen sooner, getting together and instigating the kind of policies that support change happening sooner and faster, by which I mean, if you're in the transport sector, issuing bans on, you know, the sale of petrol or diesel cars from some year into the future is perhaps the most powerful policy that can stimulate innovation and help bring the price down of the electric alternatives sooner and make them better sooner. But there's a whole load of instances like this where it's small group coalitions of actors that get together that can be enough to tip the whole international scene. And that's got to be good news, because for too long, for decades, we've been operating, trying to get to a point where we get everybody to agree on everything and repeatedly reminding ourselves that that's almost impossible to achieve.
Do listeners need a science degree to read the new Tipping Point report?
It's longer than I hoped it would be, but no, we've worked really hard to write in an accessible language. We've tried to use quite a lot of infographics, and we've tried to offer the report in little broken down chunks if you just want to pick off bits of it. We've produced some video content, animations, and other ways of just trying to offer interested listeners a way in to just learning about this stuff. So yeah, please get stuck in, and I hope we've got something to offer for everybody. And if you want the detail, it's undoubtedly there as well.
Our guest, Dr. Timothy Lenton, is a world leader in the field and chair in climate change and earth system science at the University of Exeter. Listeners, this is a gold mine of Tipping Point information. It's ready for you at globaltippingpoints.org. You put a hyphen between the words global and tipping and tipping and points, and it will work for you. Or grab the link from my show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim Lenton, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thanks so much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Former NASA chief scientist James Hansen tells us not to count carbon or measure heat. Look at the Earth energy imbalance. Reflective sea ice has crashed in both the Arctic and Antarctica. Has the energy balance changed at the poles? It turns out energy transaction at the poles is key to the movement of warmer air and ocean currents from the equator toward the temperate latitudes where most humans live. There is new science with answers. We will talk with the lead author, Hamish Prince. But I warn you, this important development is not easy to understand. That is partly because scientists are observing not from the surface, but at the top of the atmosphere, hundreds of miles upward toward space. That makes some assumptions down here sound backward. Just as a first glimpse, this is from the American Meteorological Society Journal press release, quote, "The Antarctic is absorbing more energy than the Arctic. Satellite data show differences in how the Arctic and Antarctic are responding to increased temperatures, according to a new paper by Hamish Prince and Tristan Lecuyer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Both poles are receiving increased solar energy input as melting sea ice reduces the region's reflectivity. This may affect the temperature gradient between the poles and the temperate regions that drives much of the climate system. This study finds that the warming Arctic is emitting a nearly comparable amount of this increased heat back to space, leaving the region's net energy imbalance largely unchanged despite rapid ice melt. However, the Antarctic is not emitting more heat energy to space, implying the solar radiation is being absorbed." End quote from the American Meteorological Society press release in mid-March 2024. So let us investigate these polar changes and what they mean for future climate. The poles of Earth release more heat back to space than they get. This energy flow draws from the hot equator, motivating winds and ocean currents for all of us. Is that polar energy system going out of balance? Yes, but not how you might expect. In February, the American Meteorological Society published a new perspective. The lead author is Hamish D. Prince, a New Zealand Fulbright scholar and now at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Hamish Prince, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. It's a pleasure to be speaking with you.
Yes, well, to begin, former NASA chief scientist James Hansen tells us not to count carbon or measure heat. Look at the Earth energy imbalance. Why did you choose to examine energy gain or loss at the poles?
Yeah, I 100% agree with that statement. Energy is the most fundamental aspect of the Earth system. All aspects of our climate are driven by this energy balance. From the temperature of our planet to the weather we experience are all controlled by the energy Earth receives and emits. Importantly, this continuous greenhouse gas emission is having a direct impact on Earth's energy balance that we experience as global warming. But in the polar regions, there are additional processes such as sea ice loss that further change the balance of this energy. As sea ice melts, it exposes much darker ocean underneath, increasing the amount of sunlight that is absorbed and which is experienced as warming in that region. We wanted to examine the trend of these energetic responses in these polar regions, in both polar regions, the Arctic and Antarctica, through satellite records.
What is the top of the atmosphere? Where is it? And what tools can measure energy flows there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the top of the atmosphere is considered a location up in space far above the Earth. It is the point above all of atmospheric phenomenon, above the weather we experience and the gases in the atmosphere. In practice, this just means that we're using measurements from satellites, typically around 500 miles above the Earth, just a bit higher than the International Space Station. It's a bit like thinking of the Earth as a snow globe, and we're on the outside of the glass looking back at all the fluid and complex things happening on the inside. On a more technical side of things, it also means that minimal data processing is occurring. Estimating things like surface temperature or cloud cover from space is a bit complicated, but by taking our perspective from the top of the atmosphere, we can take measurements from these sensors that have very high confidence.
Dr. Seiji Kato is a scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center. He often co-authors papers with Hansen. In 2006, working with just 4 years of satellite data, Kato and colleagues discovered something unexpected in the warming Arctic. Is your work further proof of that early study, and what is the surprise?
Yes, so in that early study, they found from a limited satellite record that loss of sea ice would increase absorbed sunlight, but they suggested that increasing cloud cover might compensate for that. However, our results don't show that, and that might not be entirely true, that solar absorption is certainly increasing in the Arctic with 15 more years of data, that increasing cloud cover is not directly balancing the more exposed ocean and increased warming from sea ice. But clouds do mask the trend a little, making it a bit less pronounced, but they're certainly not compensating for the lack of sea ice, which that earlier study in 2006 suggested.
I must have had a misunderstanding reading the paper. I thought that the Arctic was more or less in balance.
Yeah, so this is a great question and an important point to clarify. So it's about following the energy around. And so we have seen sunlight absorbed into the region, and usually that's reflected away. And in a normal climate, that might just be where the story ends. But in our current world, sea ice has been removed, and so more of that energy has been absorbed into the ocean. When we say the energy is being balanced, we're saying that that warming is going into emitting, that increased sunlight is going into warming the surface and increasing the thermal emission. The important bit of science here is that warmer objects emit more thermal radiation, and that is what we are measuring. And so when we're saying the Arctic is remaining in balance, we are saying that the increased absorbed solar radiation is going directly into warming the surface, which we can see from space.
What is your assessment of the climatic or energy impacts of the crash in summer sea ice in the Arctic? What do you think it does there?
Yeah, so firstly, is this direct impact that we've been discussing, that with a lot less sea ice, you absorb more solar radiation and you warm that surface. And it actually kicks off a positive feedback, because as you remove that sea ice, you warm the surface, which can further melt more sea ice. And that's known as the ice albedo feedback, where albedo is the term for the reflectivity. And this warming has dramatic impacts on the local ecology and communities in this region. And this is exactly what we have seen in the last 20, 30, even 40 years, that this feedback has been kicking off and our ice is further and further reducing every year. The global impacts of this are a bit more complex. A warming polar region decreases the equator to pole temperature gradient, which would certainly expect to have an impact on the climate. But that is very uncertain and is the focus of a lot of ongoing research.
I know scientists worry about a blue ocean event where most of the sea ice is gone from the Arctic Ocean, at least during summer. And researchers from the Scripps Institution at the University of California in San Diego calculated that a blue ocean event would increase energy in the atmosphere comparable to 1 trillion tons of CO2, and that would be like adding 25 years of emissions. But your study, does it throw doubt on such a large impact of a blue ocean event?
No, I'll tell you, our paper does not throw doubt onto this, but it further reinforces the statements that they are making. In that study, they looked at what an ice-free Arctic would cause, the potential warming of that through absorbed sunlight. And we just show that absorbed sunlight is directly related to the surface warming from these satellite records. The key point to keep in mind is that thermal emission that we discuss is directly proportional to the temperature at the surface. So when we say that the thermal emission is increasing at the same rate, that is equal to saying the temperature is also increasing proportionally to the increased solar radiation. We just show from the observational record that their assumptions hold very true in this current 20-year record we have.
Well, that's pretty concerning. All right, let's switch to the other end of the Earth here. If we switch to Antarctica, the technical language became for me a bit confusing. It sounds like more energy is being absorbed in Antarctica, but that is called an energy deficit. But then I realized, well, the deficit takes place not at the surface, but the whole point of view is at the top of the atmosphere. Is that right?
Yeah, so the important point is that the Arctic and Antarctica are always in an energy deficit. But as we absorb more sunlight, that deficit is reducing. We need to think a bit like an accountant here, that maybe we always lose 100 watts of energy from the region. But with absorbed solar radiation, that amount of energy being lost is being reduced, that only 80 watts are being lost every year, that the region is not losing energy as easily, that more solar radiation is being absorbed, and it's an extra source of energy into our account of all energy in the region. I hope that clarifies that.
So if I'm looking at the map that's in your paper, we have green at the poles and then warmer temperatures, obviously, around the equator and the tropics. It's just hard for us to grasp that energy is leaking away back into space more from the poles, which we think of as cold, than from the tropics.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so when we do this balance, we think about absorbed sunlight versus the emitted thermal radiation. And in the tropical regions of the planet, there is a lot of sunlight being absorbed. They're facing directly towards the sun, and it's highly concentrated solar radiation in the equator regions. And that's what gives us our warm temperatures there. But then the atmosphere and the ocean are really effective of distributing their energy around the planet, and it sends it polewards into the colder regions. And so you can think of the climate on a very basic sense as just one big cycle of energy coming into the equator, flowing towards the poles and exiting through our polar regions on a very basic sense. And so that's how we describe the deficit in the polar regions, that the energy is flowing from the equator into the polar regions and being emitted back to space, and it is the lack of solar absorption that keeps it in a deficit.
That's very interesting. I really did not realize that that was how it works. So in the paper, there is a helpful diagram and comparison between the Arctic as a shallow bathtub and the Antarctic as an energy sink. Could you expand on that for us, please, Hamish?
Yeah, so we tried to summarize our ideas in this more analogy, and this schematically made. So if you imagine a shallow bathtub of water and you were to start heating that up with a heater above it, you would feel the warmth on that water. That water is trapped in the bathtub and you will feel it warming up. This is a similar idea to removing sea ice in the Arctic. Removing the sea ice allows the sun to start warming the surface, like a heater warming a shallow bathtub, and we feel that warmth in the ocean. But if you're meant to imagine a sink of water flowing around and flowing down the drain, this is our analogy of a southern ocean. If you were to start warming that ocean, that water with a heater that's flowing around and flowing down a drain, you won't feel that water heating up because it's been taken away from the surface by the ocean circulation. And that's our analogy for Antarctica. As you remove that sea ice, you can start warming that water, but it's been taken up by the ocean through a process of ocean heat uptake. And it's highly effective around Antarctica, and that's why we're not seeing warming occurring in the oceans around Antarctica as the sea ice is being reduced. That extra energy has been taken away deep into the ocean. It's flowing around the sink of energy.
Major media worldviews, as we know, come from the Northern Hemisphere, and picturing geoengineering, like injecting reflective particles into the atmosphere, we generally would see that as happening over the Arctic. But if sea ice loss has not substantially affected the energy balance over the North Polar area, but affects Antarctica more, does this imply we should inject the particles over Antarctica, really?
I think the important point to clarify here is that more solar absorption anywhere on the planet is going to add energy to our climate system. It will cause warming somewhere on the planet. And so in Antarctica, when we're saying that it's not really affecting the surface temperatures, because that energy is going deep into the Southern Ocean, warming temperatures away from us to a place that we can't measure, that we aren't measuring. And so the absorption of solar radiation is consequential on the climate wherever that occurs. But we show that that warming is occurring in different places between the Arctic and the Antarctic through different geophysical processes. In terms of the geoengineering component, I certainly can't discuss. I'm not qualified to look at its plausibility. Our research doesn't address that.
Right. So many of our guests caution uncertainty about clouds lead to significant uncertainty about how climate change will develop. Suppose Arctic warming leads to more water vapor and so to more clouds and so less energy absorption, a kind of counter-cooling effect brought on by warming. Is that what you think is happening?
I definitely agree with you that clouds are the biggest uncertainty in the climate system, and we also address that in that paper. But this assumption that reducing sea ice will continue to increase cloud cover is highly uncertain. And like that earlier study from 2006, they suggested that this might be a consequential process, but we don't think that is the case. While they do mask a bit of the variability, we're not seeing them completely counter the warming of reducing sea ice.
So with only 20-plus years of satellite records, is it still possible energy at the poles is influenced by longer cycles and might change again in unpredictable ways?
Yeah, this is an important point. I'm glad you brought it up. Through this interview, I've been talking about ice loss around Antarctica, but that's only really started to happen in the last 6 years. And so some of these trends are driven by very dramatic losses of ice in recent years. And so certainly when we add 10 more years, 20 more years of data, it's uncertain what will happen. But one key point is that once all sea ice is lost, clearly we will have maximized our solar absorption and our maximum warming will be occurring. But then when we flip to the Antarctic component, we've been saying that the Southern Ocean has taken up heat. That heat is deep in the ocean somewhere. And at some point, we might expect that warming to emerge at the surface of the ocean. And this is another highly uncertain point of at what point will the Southern Ocean heat uptake start impacting surface temperatures of the planet. The Southern Ocean is really important for mediating the surface temperatures of our planet. Without the Southern Ocean heat uptake, our planet would be a lot warmer than it is today. And there is uncertainty of on what timescales will that heat emerge back and start adding extra warmth to our planet. Importantly, NASA's made it a top priority to continuing these measurements of radiation from space, with follow-on missions in the next decade or two decades being reported to keep this record going, which is positive to hear.
Adding it up, what can this analysis of Big Earth data tell us about polar influences on the climate in the rest of the world where we live?
Yeah, apart from this direct warming in the Arctic, the global impacts are highly uncertain, like I mentioned before. And this is actually an ongoing question in our research group here in Wisconsin-Madison. Since our climate system is directly controlled by the energy, we would certainly expect that changing the energy balance would impact our weather, maybe through the frequency or magnitude of the storms we experience. But this is pure speculation. Theoretically, there should be an impact, but we're not sure exactly what that impact will be.
From the University of Wisconsin-Madison, we've been speaking with New Zealand Fulbright scientist Hamish Prince. He is lead author of the new paper, Observed Energetic Adjustment of the Arctic and Antarctic in a Warming World. I will post a link to the helpful abstract, and the paper will be available once it's formally published later this month. Follow up with more discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Hamish, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
Agriculture is a major driver of toxicity, soil and species loss, and climate change. We all know that. If you don't live in Europe, and even if you do, it is hard to understand what farmers blocking roads with tractors has been about. According to a new editorial in the flagship journal Science, these are signs of resistance to laws designed to protect nature and a livable climate. They call it greenlash. Here is the explanation from Guillaume Chaperon, professor in the Department of Ecology at Grimso Research Station in Sweden. The title is Reverse EU's Growing Greenlash. Quote, after several weeks of violent protests, European farmers have achieved a tactical triumph that does not bode well for the future of environmental policies. In response to the demonstrations, the European Commission has enacted a derogation in the European Union's Common Agricultural Policy, called CAP, to set aside 4% of farmland for biodiversity and landscape protection, withdraw a bill to halve pesticide use, removed a target to reduce agricultural emissions by 30% by 2040, and called for further changes in the CAP to loosen environmental requirements. These retreats reflect a lack of political commitment to policies aimed at greening European agriculture. Appeasing this greenlash surely will not help Europe meet its environmental and climate challenges. The protesting farmers are demanding better consideration by politicians regarding the necessity of meeting environmental requirements, trade liberalization, and taxes. There is, however, barely any other economic sector in Europe that receives such glaring attention as farming. The EU allocates roughly one-third of its annual budget, 55 billion euros, to farming through its now 62-year-old CAP program. Farmer representatives have regular access to decision-makers at the highest level, European commissioners, heads of states or agriculture ministers across the EU, and no substantial policy change can be made without approval by the farming industry. This has made it impossible to modify the CAP program in ways that reduce the environmental impact of modern agricultural practices and promote sustainable farming. Grievances about costs, regulations, and bureaucracy by any economic sector are not surprising. However, the speed at which EU and national politicians abandon green policies reflects the strong penetration of industrial agriculture into decision spheres. Such capture of government by an interest group is dangerous. In France, for example, a special unit in the military police has been established to work with a farmer union to control environmental activism against industrial farming. In addition to EU-wide policy changes, farmers have obtained national concessions in Germany, Italy, Romania, and Spain that are mostly linked to taxes related to climate goals. The French government has gone further by proposing to ignore a court rule mandating a reduction in pesticide use while casting suspicion on the integrity of scientists working at the pesticide regulatory agency. Is this greenlash a benefit to all farmers? The EU's about-face measures are unlikely to support small farms that are truly economically struggling and instead answer the wish list of industrial farmers. In France, the farming profession displays high inequality, with a minority of wealthy industrial farmers reaping most of the public subsidies. A 7-year investigation, published last year in a book that won France's top journalism prize, found that the farming sector was under tight control of a cartel of industrial agriculture groups acting in concert with the larger farmer unions to control the supply of seeds and tools, bank loans, access to land, and the purchase of harvests in a system likened to feudalism. This in no way favors more environmentally friendly farms. Economic hardship for farmers is neither caused by a lack of consideration by politicians nor by environmental policies, but rather by an agro-political system that, regardless of evidence-based policies, is tightly controlled by those who benefit from it. How will this economic sector become sustainable if those controlling it uphold a business model that is incompatible with sustainability? Making agriculture sustainable is unlikely to be achieved if policies do not account for this institutional capture by Big Ag. Much can be learned from scholarship and expertise in political science, law, and sociology, fields that have long studied how special interest groups organize political pressure to influence policy. But actionable knowledge is also needed to understand how such political pressure can be neutered. Inspiration might be found in the European Banking Authority stress tests that examine how banks cope with adverse economic scenarios. Environmental policies could be stress-tested by an independent authority to determine whether they can withstand a hostile political climate, for example. Strengthening systems by exploring how they can go wrong or whether they can be deliberately made to fail is often referred to as red teaming. This approach could help guide the development of green policies that are still effective, even when the political context becomes unfavorable. With next June's European Parliament elections possibly reinforcing this green lash, it is more important than ever to try different approaches. Guillaume Chaperon. You should also see a policy brief called Debunking the Backlash, Uncovering European Voters' Climate Preferences. It says, for example, the notion of a broad green backlash is set to dominate this year's European election campaign. Based on a new survey data from more than 15,000 respondents in Germany, France, and Poland, we show that it is largely overblown. A majority of voters still wish for a more ambitious climate policy and would support a raft of concrete measures to bring down emissions. So there you go. And you can find the same thing in the United States, where the agricultural lobby has totally dominated Congress for far too long, and really, there's hardly any talk of them measuring up to climate change requirements that we need to survive, to stop the storms, the floods, and the fires. Same thing going on in Canada and almost every other country. So we need the farming community to get on board to save the climate that they need to produce crops that they can market and feed the world and sell to the world. And if they want to sink the ship in the meantime for the profit of industrial agriculture, which is often owned by giant corporations and companies on Wall Street, then we're not going to make it to a climate that we can survive, and we're going to run out of food, or at least certain places in the world will run out of food. I will put links to this article about the overblown backlash and the green backlash in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Be sure to take a look at that. No country is prepared for changes of 2 degrees of warming, much less 3 degrees C and beyond, and that's where we're heading. We are currently creating that future, almost subconsciously. Fossil fuel companies with their banks and investors have decided it's okay. It's just one big blind party, the last party, before the fire. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening again this week. Be kind to yourselves, and thank you for caring about this world.